This episode includes the discussion of sensitive topics related to mental health and may be activating for some listeners. We encourage you to take care of yourself. For support and resources, visit beam.community/get help now.
What's up, everybody? I'm YOLO.
I'm Natalie.
And this is Black Healing Remix, the podcast. So Natalie, today I want to talk a little bit about this moment where everybody's talking about wellness and healing and mental health.
Timelines flooded.
And I'm really grateful for that, right? I mean, as somebody who's doing public health and community health work for several years, right? I remember the moment 10 years ago when it was so difficult to have conversations about mental health in mainstream, quote unquote,
Yeah, the spaces. Person who put the thing on Facebook and said, oh, I'm feeling like this. Everybody was like, oh my goodness, what's going on? Yes, I remember that time too.
And so it's wild because now we're in this moment. Everyone's talking about things, which is wonderful and beautiful. But one of the things I have to say that I'm concerned about as someone who, you know, works in public health, works in community health, is I'm seeing a lot of people who have skills and talents, but are overstepping the boundaries of what their skills and talents can provide people who are in legitimate distress. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about crystal healers, talking about this crystal and this tea going to help get you rid of your bipolar. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about yoga teachers talking about they diagnosing people with certain kind of conditions, mm-hmm. or even people who are just taking up the mantle of healer and doing a lot of practices without a community of support, without a community of accountability, and sometimes without any training from anyone. It's kind of like picking up books and feeling like they can experiment on folks, sometimes causing a lot of harm.
Absolutely.
And so this is something that's really alarming to me because, you know, at Beam, we are really explicit about talking about honoring the diversity of the spectrum of healers, right?
Absolutely.
That yoga teachers, that energy healers, that like herbalists, that
they all
therapists,
have a place.
We have a place. But I'm also really nervous and concerned because I see some people overstepping into spaces that are really hurting people.
Absolutely.
You know, I don't know if you see something like this in your...
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing for me is, you know, we look on socials and people are sharing a lot about what they're navigating. And then I equally see a lot of people who are like the guru suddenly, yeah. Where it's like, homie, I knew you 2 weeks ago. You was not on this, but now this is the vibe and this is the wave. And so now you have an inspirational quote and now you're holding retreats and you doing ayahuasca with people, right? Like there is this overstepping of everybody can do really deep work. And I think everybody has work they can contribute.
Yeah.
But I think when we think about people who are experiencing tremendous mental health crisis and distress, I don't know if that's the best place, if your Instagram timeline is the best place to be getting the support that you deserve and that would most serve you.
Yeah. I think we also don't understand the distinctions within wellness and mental health, right? So I'm thinking about, like, even, first of all, even with therapists, let's start with therapists, right? People tend to assume that a therapist has all the knowledge of every single support, right?
Yes,
like knows how to support every condition, knows how to support universally, is this ethical, moral person. And that's not the reality.
That's
we know that's not the reality.
And we work with a lot of therapists and they tell us, there are things I don't know how to handle. Clients come to me and they have certain things going on and I have to refer them to someone else because
exactly.
I am not an expert in that and I'm not always certain how to navigate it. And so we recognize that on both sides of it.
Yes.
Therapists are recognizing there are limitations
Absolutely.
To the work that I do and the way the work can happen.
Yes.
And equally, there's people who obviously share stories with us about unethical treatment going on with them. Yeah.
And I think that's the important piece. Like, you know, I was reading Dr. Thomas Enso, who is the former director of the National Institutes of Health. And he was talking about that about 60% of therapists in this particular time period, I can't remember the exact time period, but were not trained in science-based interventions to support people with serious mental illness. I thought it was really profound, right? So it may begin to question, like, what are they trained in, right? And then when you dig a little deeper, you start to realize that actually the people who have serious mental illness are often not treated by therapists, right?
Mm-hmm.
They actually are treated, like, in by emergency rooms and, like, you know, inpatient work, right? So there's a little bit of a distinction there. But I think what happens when we have these conversations on therapy, I'm like, get a therapist. Well, is this therapist a good fit for you? Is this therapist able to have the skill set? Are they trained in the curriculum that will actually support you in your wellness? Like, it's not just a one size fits all. And therapists are not these absolute, brilliant, like completely all-knowing beings, which is what strangely starts to happen. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of therapists on social media kind of marrying some of the more undesirable elements of the kind of evangelical preacher tradition, where it's like, now not only am I speaking for God, but I'm speaking for God as a therapist. So now I am the ultimate power. And that's alarming to me.
Yeah.
Right? Because I think that if any situation you're going into, a therapist, whoever, for it to be healing for me, you have to be in a co-healing dynamic. And what I say is a co-healing dynamic is that, in my opinion, a therapist, a healer, or a wellness person is a guide and a support on your journey. But you have to be engaged in it too. You have to be actively opening, sharing, participating, saying at times, that don't feel good.
Because also, when you think about anything, I think about massage very often, right? And someone who is well-versed in that and is a healer in that form of support, right? They're just meeting your body for the first time, right? And I think about how often, like, people, you go to massage and you're like, and for me, my journey was, I would be getting these massages and I only like soft touch. But because I exist in a big body, people think that I need to be pressed on so hard, right? And so I would get these massages trying to find relief and comfort. And I would be like, ow, ow, ow. The whole time I would be internally suffering. And now combine this with multiple experiences of sexual violence. Now I'm scared to speak up. Right? And so I'm sitting in this thing that should be supportive and helpful to me, right? That's what it's designed to be. But then I'm caught in the midst of this, feeling uncomfortable, not knowing how to say, hey, I don't like this, or I feel uncomfortable not trying to offend them, right? You see how all the things can come together to really create this experience. And of course, this is a small example of what could be happening on a much larger scale for people in larger emotional distress, right? And so I think that's a really good illustration of sometimes how people, number one, lose their voice in a process, but also assume they understand what the dynamics of something is and how are we being educated about what to do in the first time you go to therapy. I think about the tools that we have on our website where we talk about things to consider prior to going to therapy. When you're in your first session with a therapist, here are some things to ask, right? If you want to change therapists, here are some things to think about, right? Like, we've designed these tools to be able to support people to navigate them, because that can be so tricky.
Yeah, it can be so tricky. And I think that another piece of it, like, and first of all, I want to thank you for sharing that example. I'm curious to know, like, imagine people listening who've been in similar situations. How are you working through or navigating being able to elicit those boundaries for yourself? Or where are you at in your journey?
Yeah, so at first I was like, push through. You're a tough Black girl. And then I was like, girl, that's bullshit and it ain't gonna work, right? You're traumatizing yourself more over again, right? And then I was like, okay, I need, because at first I was like, oh, anybody can massage me. And I was like, but I'm getting triggered by these dudes who they doing too much, right? So then I was like, I'm only gonna be massaged by women. So that was my first step. And then I went to, when I get a massage, I explicitly say, I have experienced sexual violence. I need you to communicate what you're doing and when you're doing it. That will really help me be able to relax. Now, the first time I said it, I was like, oh my God, I am so terrified to say this. And the woman said back to me, I'm a survivor too, I got you. And I was like, oh, we on. I was like, I'm about to say this every single time. And then, and now it's become a ritual and a practice for me to advocate for myself. The same thing when I go to a chiropractor. Mm-hmm. I went to a chiropractor and I was like so uncomfortable. I was like, you just doing stuff and you moving me in way. I was like, okay, I need to just establish, like, here's who I am in the world. And I'm coming here not to be violated, not to be more traumatized. And if I advocate for myself by using my voice, now this changes the whole dynamic, because also now you know, I know what's up, right? It changes the power dynamic. And for me, that's really helpful to being able to, like, be relaxed, because I come in saying, hey, I'm mindful of these things and I need you to be also.
I love that. That's powerful.
It's powerful. I mean, it is practice. It is contending with myself. It is talking with my therapist about it, right? It's all the things, and being like, no, but I deserve care. I deserve to be treated in a way that actually honors me, not just like, well, everybody gets massages and they're fine. Why am I not? I don't care why I'm not. There's a whole list of stories of why I'm not. And also, today I need this massage and I need you to be ethical while providing me care and support.
Yeah. It also makes me so disturbing to me that, like, that's not a mandatory part of masseuse training. Like, before I touch you, how I touch you, I'm going to let you know what's happening. Like, I experienced a similar thing when I was as a yoga teacher, right? I went to a school, you know, that was led by brown people. I'm grateful to be taught by Indian folks about, like, yoga. But it was a lot of white folks there, and other studios that I was a part of, there was a lot of white folks. And I was always shocked at how much non-consensual touching happened. Mm-hmm. Like, how much there was an adjustment to your waist, and you were like, whoa, you didn't ask me if you could touch my waist.
Yeah,
you could
actually touch my waist. Push it back.
They're moving your body and doing things with your body without saying the simple, hey, is it okay to touch you? Mm-hmm. Is it okay? Even I've heard people say things like, I'm going to touch you right now. It's like, that's not it.
That's me.
You're not letting me know I'm going to touch you right now. You're going to ask me, is it okay to touch me?
Yeah.
You're going to ask. And so consent-based practice is not very common when it comes to yoga teaching, when it comes to masseuse, unfortunately, but that needs to be a standard, right? It needs to be a standard even in therapy. I think about psychiatry too, right? I think it's so important. Like, for me, I had to learn or unlearn the conditioning that I feel like we as Black folks get, where when you go to the doctor, you kind of hang your head down low and just, and then whatever they say, you just kind of listen to.
Yeah, they must know everything because they're the doctor.
And then they rush you out of the space. And I had to go to the space where with my therapist and with my doctor, I'm like, I have questions. I pay a lot of money to be here. So you have time. And okay, first, I know the first time I did it, he was like, whoa, okay. But he sat down and listened to what I had to say, right? Because yeah. I think that sometimes in the training of physicians, they are trained to be so dismissive to your needs. And then, God forbid, you got a white doctor and you Black, that all that bias comes in. Or I've had many Black straight doctors who, the minute they see I'm gay, that judgment and shame comes in. Mm-hmm. They're like, okay, what kind of sex you have? Like, you know, you can feel that shame, right? Same thing can happen in your therapeutic relationship, right?
Absolutely.
Someone who's a therapist can do something or say something that does not feel good for you, and it's okay for you to say, I don't like that, I want to stop, or I need to understand what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that we tell our folks that, because we know that so often doctors, therapists, a lot of different practitioners are not as thoughtful or safe with for us.
And when you think about, you know, because part of me is thinking about all the healers that I know that are well-intentioned, right? But also are a part of these raggedy systems, right? I have a fantastic doctor. She's a part of a terrible system where she has 13 minutes or whatever, you know, some very short amount of time to talk to me about everything that's going on with my body. And then be like, okay, great. Okay, I'll send you an email, because she got to keep moving. Because if she doesn't, now she's reprimanded. She's documented in the system, true. All of these different things. True. And so I think about the healers who are a part of systems, right? Yes. That some of what we consider like the reckless or carelessness or poor bedside manner is really because of the systems that they're a part of and the ways in which they've been trained. But equally, for folks who are not being trained, right, who have a more organic path to their healing journey and the offerings that they have in the world, there's no accountability.
Yeah.
But there's also no community saying, hey, right? Because if you build a business and you are whatever, if I say, hey, YOLO, I'm nervous about, people go, well, this is my business. Mm-hmm. If you want to do it this way, then you worry about your own business, right? Yeah. And so I wonder about that dynamic of where are the checks and the balances? Is there a necessity for them? And then who's caught in the crossfire?
Well, and I also understand that the checks and the balances don't exist as thoughtfully as we would like them to be for therapists and psychiatrists.
Right.
I mean, we talk about psychiatrists having really unprecedented power to institutionalize people, to reject family recommendations, to hold people literally hostage within institutions off of their assessments.
Yeah.
Like, we're talking about, like, abuses of power. And even with physicians and therapists, when there are times in which grievances happen, the process is often very labored for people. Or there's often, like,
or it's a fake process.
Right, it's a fake process. Even the people like, oh, well, you know, I'm licensed and there's accountability. Is there? Have you ever tried to file a grievance with a social worker out there? Do you know what that process is like?
Yeah.
And how it can be grueling on the person? Mm-hmm. So I think that, like, while I'm grateful there is some structure that needs to be clearly sharpened, I do worry, like you, about the healers who are like, I feel compelled to help people, but I don't understand, or I don't have enough skills and tools. I don't understand that I don't have the skills and tools to go in as deep as I'm trying to go. It's like saying that I started swimming classes yesterday, and now I'm finna go into the 15 feet in the pool. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, whoa, bruh, like, you gotta slow down.
Gotta stay in that kiddie pool.
And you gotta think about who are the people next to you who are gonna pull you in and be like, these are skills and tools. Like, for example, like, I think about like some things we talk about with different kinds of facilitators, right? Mm-hmm. There's a difference between a facilitator and often a therapist, because every therapist is not a facilitator.
Right.
Right.
And some people are just great at holding space.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
But that doesn't mean you know how to facilitate.
Which is guide someone to somewhere, which is guide and move people through a process emotionally.
Based on who the unique people are and what's happening in the room and the energy and all the dynamics. That is a different level.
That's a different level. And a lot of people who have these licenses and degrees, like psychologists that I work with, who will admittedly say, I'm not a facilitator. I can't do what you do to move a group through a process emotionally.
And also,
that's not how I work.
And also think about how often when we're in session with folks, we're training, and the things that we're training them on, they say, I have never been trained on any of this. This is the thing that when my patients come to me, I have no idea what to do because I've never been trained. And in this 4-hour training, y'all have taught me how to navigate this.
And it happens a lot in our trainings where so there are often therapists and clinicians who come in and they're just like flabbergasted at the framing we have. And it makes me angry, and it's disturbing because, you know, first of all, we kind of assume, just like with doctors or in a lot of any other training, that like you're getting this training that's ethical and safe and like and the most progressive, but it's not what's happening, right?
No, first of all, I in no way do I think the training of hardly anything is the most progressive.
Right.
So we have to be clear about that, like when we're setting up systems, right, and assembly lines for something. Mm. That will not be the highest quality of care. In fact, it will be the minimum requirement, right? We're meeting the requirements. And I go, is that how we want our folks cared for?
Yeah.
The people who are in the most distress, that's the system they're gonna engage?
Yeah.
That's a healer. I think about the pandemic and how many people needed therapy, right? And were desiring it. And the assembly line of therapists being overrun with clients and patients and like not even doing the proper due diligence or paperwork or case notes or anything to make sure that folks were being properly supported.
I will say this, and it may not be a popular stance to say, but I have deep concerns also for the well-being of therapists, because I think that the way that therapy is constructed is actually not healthy for them as well.
No, how could it be?
I mean, like, when I think about some people I know, you're sitting on a couch or you're sitting in a room for hours on end, hearing people share things, you're helping them work through things. And I'm thinking about, you know, this is me as my somatics yoga teacher. I'm like, how are you getting your body? How are you getting them in their body? I think about some therapists I know in our network who talk about like taking their clients to the basketball court when they work with kids, and they process on the basketball court, going on walks together. I'm like, there's so many dynamic things, but that's not how many clinicians are trained in that discipline. They're trained to be, this is the model, as opposed to like, let's be dynamic. Let's figure out other ways to kind of engage. And I feel like, you know, there's so much therapist burnout. How many folks in our network do we know who are like, I can't even see clients right now because I'm overwhelmed and distressed?
Or have retired.
Yes.
Because they're like, I'm a former therapist.
Yeah.
Because this system is not giving life in the way that I thought it was.
No.
And we hear that very, very often. Therapists saying, it's not all it's cracked up to be. And how I can support people isn't always what they need, which I think is you know, some of the stories that you've shared with me about, like, I don't think that the way people are being supported is the best way, and therefore trying to create new systems to be able to support people where they actually are.
The systems piece is really important when we talk about any practitioner, because we have to really look at how that, what you said, like the assembly line is creating. And we also have to talk about some individual responsibility and community responsibility as well.
Yeah.
Right.
It's both and.
Yeah, it's both and. And I think that like what's happening, you know, I think about an example of a story I had with someone who is a very prominent healing and wellness leader. And we had a kind of disagreement around this idea that healing was finite. He was very committed to this idea that like, oh no, you need to heal that, and you can heal that, and it can be done, and you'll never have to deal with that ever again. And I was like,
I want to know what world he lives in, because I want to go there if that's true. I want to go where that is.
But to me, that's reflective of what level and dimension of training and research and reading have you done that has led you to be so rigid and not understand the human experience? And like, here you have this huge platform, and now people feel shame because they're not over something that happened 30 years ago, or because they're activated about something that happened yesterday. And I'm like, you're out here teaching this. And because you are a man, you will be read this way. You will be trusted with a lot of vulnerable people, a lot of vulnerable women, I would say, as well. And so I'm always alarmed about the ways in which, because I'm always checking my ideas and concepts, right? To see, like, what am I teaching? What am I sharing? Does this feel right? Mm-hmm. And having people around me who can say no, and me listen and be like, oh, I hear where you're going to that place. But there are a lot of people who are in various different kind of healing modalities, who have some of our platforms and some who are working with people under the auspice of coaching, spiritual leadership, etc. And it's very evident the dimension of their skill is not as strong as they purport it to be, or they don't understand that they might be harming a lot more people than they're helping.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it makes me curious about, like, what is the desire to tell people that you can get over something permanently?
Very interesting.
Right? Because what I know about my own lived experience is that what has made me most powerful is that every single thing I've experienced is useful. Mm. That it has sparked something in me, whether curiosity, whether the opportunity to see life differently, whether it is the opportunity to forgive myself or someone else, right? It's all been useful. It's one of the things my mom says, you know, she thinks is most brilliant about me. She says, you use it all. Mm-hmm. She says, I see other people, they throw away stuff. Mm-hmm. They don't want to hold the whole thing.
Yeah.
They want to move from it. And you will take the whole thing and go, yes, even the worst days, I want those too. Because what I found is that there is a day when they are useful, right? When I can go, ooh, I know, okay, I clocked that. I did this in this way this time. I'm gonna do that different this time. Mm-hmm. But if we discard it all, we delete. Now it's not useful to you. Yeah. You can't recall it. You can't make it useful. And I go, so what is the point of all of these life lessons, all of this pain, all of these things, if we can't use it?
Yes.
If we can't turn it into something, the artist in me is like, turn it into something beautiful. Yeah. At the end of all this shit, y'all gonna know I've been through some shit and it's gonna be beautiful as hell. You know why? Because I used it all. Mm. In every single thing that I'm doing, I'm using it, right? And you were talking about my light before. I'm gonna light it up because otherwise I'm gonna be sitting here like, oh my God, and then my dad, and then it's like, what? Yeah. That ain't the pulse of the moment. That's not fully living. And I can't connect with other people if I'm deleting the things that you know, in some ways cultivated the opportunity for who I would become.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what happens when you have irresponsible framework that you're kind of sharing, right? And I want to also hold this with the fact that, like, there are a lot of community healers, indigenous healers, people who are doing healing with crystals, people doing energy work, who are highly ethical and so highly ethical. Accountable and very cautious and mindful, and will tell you, that's not my domain.
And they typically say no.
Yes.
Very often.
Right.
They work in limited hours, right? Yeah, yeah. They are cultivating sacred space for themselves. Mm-hmm. To stay aligned.
Yes.
Right? They're not like, oh yeah, I heal everyone all the time. Mm-hmm. They're like, y'all got me for these 3 days. After that, I'm in Tahiti because I got to pull it together and come back when I am resourced. Yeah. Right? And so I think about all the therapists and just wellness workers and different people who they burn out. Mm-hmm. They tired. They talking about how they need, they met, all this stuff. And I'm not sure what you can offer someone into deep distress.
Yeah.
If you yourself are in deep distress.
Yeah. Ooh, I'm so glad we're having this conversation because I'm really alarmed at the ways in which everybody's yelling, go to therapy, and everybody's kind of, my therapist said. I'm like, sometimes people say that my therapist said something.
And I was like, sis,
I
cancel.
Need to have that person's license number because I have some questions about how that was communicated. You know what I mean? Like, so it's just like, we need to realize we're engaging humans and we have to be active agents in the process. We can't just assume they have all the power or that they're always right, that they're always correct. No, this is a person who has a skill, hopefully, who's been trained well with a skill, hopefully. You know what I mean? And I need to assess them just like I assess the barber. Like, you know, I'm keep going back to that example I use. And just like if that barber, if my line looks funky, I'm going to have a question.
I'm going to have no questions. I'm going to be like, thank you. Good luck. I'm not coming back, right? But also recognizing with mental health, that becomes challenging to advocate for ourselves.
It does.
I think about, you know, when I had my most recent sexual assault experience, and I was sharing with my therapist about the experience. And she said to me, why would you put yourself in that situation? And I was like, hold up. So here's the thing. What you not finna do is blame me for someone else's actions. That's not what we're doing today. Secondly, this is our last session because you are clearly not qualified to support me through what I am navigating. And it was like, only because I have all of this training, because I have all of this experience, did I know, hold up, sis, you saying this ain't even it, right? And then I could create a boundary And then, you know, later in the session, she's like, yeah, I don't think I'm the right therapist because I'm not trained and I'm really not trained to be able to like support you through something this deeply traumatizing. And I'm like, well, sis, then what are we doing here? Why are you, you know what I mean? Like, if you are not able to support the breadth of what might come up, why wouldn't you communicate that in the beginning to say, here's my expertise, here's what I can hold. Yeah. And I think about, I am a person who does mental health work. Mm-hmm. Right? And these are the experiences that I'm having. So what are the experiences of our community who do not have this much information, these many resources, this much advocacy in them, right? Mm-hmm. What is happening to them? And so I stand with you in terms of like this rage around like, no, this ain't it, because so much harm is happening and to people who are seeking out help.
Yes.
And that's really, really dangerous.
That's a powerful example. And like, think about like, what would it mean if like clinicians were to come up front and say that? And I'm also like really upset that you experienced that. That like literally you were in this moment where you're really trying to be vulnerable and share an experience. And here comes patriarchy, misogyny through this person trying to shift focus away from the real choice someone else made and make them yours. That's a horrible experience, you know, to have. And but it's also an experience so many of us also have as well. Which is unfortunate, right?
And it also was a reminder to me as far as we think we've come.
Yeah.
Right? With as many people having therapy, what is the quality of the therapeutic intervention that they're having?
Yeah.
Right? When people don't know that they can say, hey, this is what I'm looking for in a therapist. So many people come to me and they'll say, oh, well, I say, you know, you're going to therapy now. I'm so excited for you. How is that going? Right? I do the check-in with people because I'm like, what's your therapist talking about? And they're like, oh, well, you know, I guess it's okay. I wish they were this way, right? They'll say their wish list of, I wish I was being supported in this way, or I wish they were talking about this, or, you know, whatever. And I say, you know, you're in charge of your session.
You know, you're paying for this
session. You are paying for this session. If your needs are not met, you need to communicate that to the therapist.
Which can be a difficult thing.
Their job is to support you. Absolutely scary, terrifying, all the things. Mm-hmm. And guess what? They're going to get their money every time you sit down.
Come on now.
And so are we going to get our needs met, or are we going to be like, let me just give you my money and you over here going to Barney's, but I'm over here still going through stuff and not supported, but spending my money. That ain't it either.
Yeah.
And so recognizing that like as a community, we have to know
that
we get to ask questions.
Yep.
We get to say, hey, this is what support looks like for me. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about why you're asking me this question, right? Is there another way you might help me navigate this thing? This feels like too large of a step for me. What would be a smaller step?
This medication makes me feel this way and I don't feel comfortable with it. Right. What are my other options? Can you support me in the journey of discovering other options? I think that happens a lot with folks who are taking medications.
Yep.
Is that what happens is you have this medication which makes you feel underwater and all the variety of side effects, because the reality is that many mental health medications come with side effects. But like, if you don't feel comfortable, a lot of people don't feel comfortable advocating and say, I don't like this, so they just stop taking them.
Well, and also and then, very like, many, you know, doctors and folks prescribing medication are saying, this is the answer.
Yes, exactly.
And you're like, okay.
And so those are two pieces, right? Right. So one, it's like, maybe I do feel like I want to engage medication as a strategy, but I'm scared to say that I feel uncomfortable with, I don't feel good about the side effects. So I stop, which has other kind of implications potentially, right? And then there's a piece about like, you know, I talked to a lot of Black psychiatrists in our network about monitoring and effective monitoring and the ways in which Black folks are monitoring. When I say monitoring, it's like when you take your medication, when you're coming in, you're check-ins or checking your blood and all this stuff and like making sure, seeing how your progressing with the medication and how that doesn't happen for a lot of Black folks, a lot of Black children.
Or not as often as it should happen.
Right, in the same way, right? So I'm thinking about that dimension of like that happening. And you're right. We have to recognize and hold that while medicine can be a powerful intervention and tool, there are big interests in this country that are not, that are interested in the quick fix of the pill, as opposed to recognizing that like depression and bipolar and schizophrenia need broader societal interventions, not just this quick fix pill. Right? And the ways in which overdiagnosing and diagnostic inflation happen to create this space where everybody is getting a pill. It's like, well, okay, wait, what? Because like any tool can be dangerous depending on your relationship to it.
Yes.
Medicine can be great in relationship to it. Yoga can be dangerous depending on your relationship to it, right? All these things. So it's about what, I think as a culture, we have to ask this question, what is our relationship to these mental health medications? Are they useful for what we're doing? Because like, there's a lot of research that talks about like the question, a lot of questions about SSRIs, selective serotonin intake and reuptake inhibitors, like with depressive, like for depression, right? There's a lot of question about like, you know, the effectiveness of some of these medications versus the side effects, right? And we have a right to ask those questions.
And we have to ask, who's funding?
Yes.
The diagnosis.
Oh, yes.
That is leading,
yes,
to people needing to be on medication.
Absolutely.
And how often is that being manipulated such that,
yep,
pills are the first option,
yep,
for many folks,
mm-hmm,
when maybe another intervention actually would be the right thing?
But the thing about it is, and you know, Dr. Thomas Insel and his book From Mental Health to Mental Illness talks about this a lot. Social people intervention is what we know supports people with mental conditions. You know, we know that having navigation around care, having social support, people who've had similar diagnoses than you can often be very dynamic and transformative and helpful.
I.e. community. People.
But it's expensive.
Yes.
It's one of the reasons that I have such a beef with, like, well, I'm grateful that in this country we're talking about peer specialists and making them professional, but they're paid crap wages. So it's like, you've got a peer specialist who's being paid to live at the poverty line to do really rigorous and hard work.
Right.
People who've been in conditions that they've been and be triggered and activated. All the
and time. So my beef with all of this is everything's expensive.
Yeah.
But we still got Maseratis.
Hmm.
We still sending people to space.
Okay.
People still got yachts. So is it that things are too expensive,
hmm,
or we are spending money in ridiculous ways?
Yeah. I mean, there's a large argument as well that Rob Wimpond, who's the author of the book, I want to make sure I say it correctly, Your Consent is Not Required. And he talks about like this myth of the healthcare is underfunded. He said, I think actually it's not that healthcare is underfunded. It's just like, where is the funding going to,
yes,
and for what,
yes,
right? And so he talks about like, you know, this is a billion-dollar industry. Where is the money going,
yeah,
is the question when we would start tracing and picking up the dollars. So diagnostic inflation, people who are listening or watching, is essentially something that happens where the diagnostic criteria in the DSM, which is Diagnostic Statistical Manual, kind of the Bible of psychiatry and mental health in the West.
Which, if you don't know about the DSM,
if you do, you
take
know.
A night off from Google, from Netflix, and go ahead and Google the DSM and the history of the DSM.
Right.
Honey, it is riveting.
It's riveting.
It is riveting. It is riveting.
It's very riveting. So what happens with the DSM is that essentially these criteria for depression gets inflated. And when they say diagnostic inflation, it means that what was once a very like precise criteria for who could qualify for this condition gets expanded. And the expansion is curious because people begin to wonder, well, who is funding or supporting the research around this expansion? Because what ends up happening now, where at one point it was only you and me could be meeting this criteria, now there's a whole bunch of people.
Me, you, your cousin, your mama, and everybody else.
Which creates other avenues for medication.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so there's a lot of like activists, disability justice activists, mad activists who have a lot of questions about diagnostic criteria. Alan Francis, who was formerly on the DSM committee, actually has a lot of questions. He talks about this. He has this book called Saving Normal. And while I don't care for the framing of saving normal, we're not trying to save normal. What he's trying to say is he's recognizing how diagnostic inflation is being used as a tool of companies to over-medicate people and make people, everyone, have a condition and making everyday humanness
a
now
problem.
A pathology.
Yeah, it's right? Now a problem to solve, which means there's money to make off of it.
Yes.
And welcome to capitalism.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, like, this is dangerous.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
This is deeply harmful. And when we think about deeply marginalized folks, when we think about Black trans folks, when we think about the most marginalized, yeah, in our community, who again and again and again will be deeply impacted,
yeah,
by what I think is really criminal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
this,
yeah,
misuse and taking advantage of, you know, folks who are not in a position to advocate for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of dimensions to that. I mean, I just think about also the ways in which people, you know, are often like, you know, drugged in ways that are not helpful when they're institutionalized or when they're brought, mm-hmm, into inpatient care,
mm-hmm,
right? And the impact of that.
And when you think about some of, you know, some films from the 80s and the 90s, and you see people being institutionalized, you always see them being drugged.
Yeah.
You always see that as part of what is normal. And I think, you know, as just people, right, we watch that and we go, oh, this is entertainment. But what is this based on?
Yeah.
Where did we get the idea that everyone who's institutionalized needs to be drugged to the point of drooling?
Yeah, even that term institutionalized is like, you know, it's, I mean, like, brought in, it's not brought into care because it's not care, no. Right? Like, so it's, in like, it's like really like imprisoned almost is the mm-hmm. more appropriate term for yeah. what's really happening, yeah. right? I did a conversation a while back called the Black People Left Behind, talking about, you know, all across this country, there are Black people who are imprisoned because of mental conditions and distress. There are folks in these behavioral health hospitals, quote unquote, because of distress, who are literally left behind. Mm-hmm. When we think about racial justice and social justice, we're often not thinking about those folks, right? We're not thinking about, you know, folks who are living with schizophrenia, who are often dismissed and denied, particularly around this, like, this bourgeoisie stuff, right? And, you know, it's like they're not the Black people we're trying to bring to safety, right? Like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I just think about those dimensions. It's like why it's so necessary for us to always uphold, when it's particularly in healing justice work, to think about the folks at the margins, right? The folks whose conditions are not the, everybody can talk about depression and anxiety, but are we talking about schizophrenia like that? Are we talking about borderline personality like that? Are we talking about, like, you know, postpartum depression not like that? Like, there's a lot of things we're not.
And also, do we even know what those things actually mean?
Yeah.
Do we know what the signs of the signs and symptoms of these things are? And then do we know how to navigate it? Should it be us or someone we care about one yeah. day? And the answer is no, yeah. because when mental health, you know, things happen in people's families, no one knows what to do.
Yeah. And it's so funny. Not only do we know that piece, but also I think about, do we understand where the pain this might be stemming from? So Dr. Bruce Perry has a book with Oprah Winfrey called What Happened to You? It's a really great book. I recommend you read it. Oprah talks about her experience. Dr. Bruce Perry talks about his experience with wellness and mental health. And one of the things that's really brilliant about what he talks about, I think it was one piece he's talking about, like, some of the personality disorders or different conditions. He said, as opposed to framing it this way, he said, thinking about it like this, with the personality disorders, you have someone who has become highly dysregulated and developed very highly maladaptive coping strategies to navigate their pain and distress. And I was like, wow, that's such a different way to think about that. Because when you hear this BPD or personality disorder, oh, you're like, oh God, you crazy.
There's a lot going on.
Like, you don't think that, like, oh, this is a person who's been in pain, who has developed a variety of different strategies to navigate that pain that are not helpful for them.
And I think the lens that we talk about mental health in the country generally is always over there. Mm-hmm. It's something that's going on. It's too much and we don't know how to deal with it. And so just get it away from me, essentially. Yeah. But we know that every single person has mental health.
Yes.
That over the course of a lifetime, people are going to experience tremendous life stressors.
Absolutely.
And traumatic events. And so recognizing that, like, avoiding the conversation of mental health and care and spending any time thinking about that is frankly dangerous for each of us, because across our lifetime, we are going to be impacted,
yes.
whether it is us or someone we know and love and care about.
Absolutely.
And so, like, not finding a solution, or at least not even beginning to think about it,
yeah.
to me is deeply, deeply troubling, you know?
Yep, it is. You know, as a healing justice worker, you know, I've done a variety of different health and wellness interventions, taught effective behavioral health interventions for the CDC, taught comprehensive risk counseling services, personalized cognitive counseling, all these things, and also created interventions, right? And done research projects. I think it's always important for us, wherever we are as practitioners, to know our boundaries and our limitations,
100%.
To know what we don't do, right? For whatever reason. And so I really want to implore you, if you are doing healing work, to begin to think about your limitations. What are your strengths and your powers? And what are also the things that you need to know that you are not good at? And help support people around you in helping see those things in themselves as well. And getting further skills or further collaboration. Because I wonder what it would be like if therapists were collaborating with life coaches instead of arguing on Twitter all the time about who's the true healer or whatever that looks like. Because, like, there are some life coaches who are doing amazing work.
Absolutely brilliant work.
Right? Yeah. And there are some crystal healers who I'm like, that's a dope way to relate to those concepts.
Mm-hmm.
There are some astrologers who I'm like, oh, you really help people build self-reflexivity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great tool.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There are some group facilitators who can hold a space and move people through an emotional process in a way that I think is so beautiful, endearing, and necessary for collective work.
Yo, look, all if you want to talk about me, just talk about me.
Oh, my
me.
Lord
just
Jesus. Okay, well, there you go. Okay. But yes, all those pieces. So we need us all, but we also need to support our folks with helping to understand the signs of, this may not be a great place for me. This might not be healthy.
And recognizing our capacity as individuals, but also professionally. Because I think that's the thing that bumps up against each other, right? Is people who want to do good work and want to help and usher people into whatever the next iteration of themselves, that work is endless. And so where are the breaks? Mm. Where are the pauses? Where is your own healing mm-hmm. in that process? And are we building in time to assess our process? Mm. To assess if the way we're doing it
is really helping,
is the way that it needs to be done in this current climate.
Yep.
And when we think about the pandemic and we think about life after the pandemic, right? People don't want to talk about the pandemic no more because it's over. Mm-hmm. But folks who are navigating disabilities, folks who are navigating all kind of, right? Like yeah. they are still in this pandemic Absolutely. While everybody outside, right? And so recognizing that we all have to understand our limitations and recognize that like, part of it is about being self-reflexive
yes.
and going, well, if I've done it the way I've always done it, but the world around me is different, mm-hmm. is that still useful? Is that still helpful?
Yep.
And I think the curiosity is the important piece, not the judgment, right? Oh, that's a bad thing or this is a good thing. Not useful to us, right? But being like, how am I contributing to the culture of healing? Mm-hmm. Who could I work with, right? Mm-hmm. I wish healers work together more.
Yeah.
Because there's more opportunities for better, like for a different dimension of healing
yes.
when we collaborate. Absolutely. And I think that's the brilliance of the work we get to do at Beam is we get to bring
yes.
all different kinds of healers together. And I think about the work that we did in Buffalo mm-hmm. after this mass shooting happened. And we went to go support that community because we felt like it was important. Right? And we pulled up with 8 different kinds of healers.
We had aromatherapy. We had a therapist, a traditional counseling psychologist. We had a sound bath healer, right? We came in as with our healing facilitation work. And like one of the things we got from so many folks in Buffalo was that like they had never had an opportunity to engage so many different practices.
All at once,
right? And like in different ways, in different spaces and times. And so I know I learned a lot from that experience, right? I learned about the importance of giving people different entry points. There were certain people who came into that space in Buffalo and were like, oh, the sound bath was important. That really helped me.
Mm-hmm.
And then there some people who came into the peer circle that we led and they were like, YOLO, when you said that and y'all did that, that really helped me. But then it was people who liked the coloring. Oh, and she gave me the aromatherapy spray, that sage. It makes me feel like I can kind of open up more, right?
And some people came and they said, I didn't know what to expect.
Yes.
And we started dancing in that floor and they started getting on the phone, calling their cousins, talking about, hey, y'all, they all right. Y'all better come on down here because this is feeling good, right? And recognizing that that's what our folks need.
Yes.
We don't all need the same thing, exactly. but we all have some need.
Yes.
And so where do we go to fill it,
yeah.
to be met, to be resourced?
Yes.
And are those things actually good for us or just on the surface?
Yep.
They are. And I talk to my mom about that a lot because she'll see stuff, you know, on social media and she doesn't have the same lens. Obviously, there's a generational lens. So she can't spot the fake things, right? So she'd be like, well, they said they're going to do X, Y, Z. And I'd be like, girl, that's a scam. Right. And recognizing that even generationally.
Yes.
Right. We have to be mindful
yes.
of when we're bringing these kind of interventions to our elders, recognizing that some of this stuff is going to churn up
a lot.
And are they in a place to do this aggressive kind of thing that you're doing?
Yeah.
Right. And so really being mindful of each of our boundaries, but also healer boundaries, I think is so important.
I love that. Thinking about this episode and affirmation, to kind of summarize it, I'm curious about, I have some things come to my head, but I'm curious about what's coming to your mind. Because we've been talking about, you know, this, the wellness industry, the mental health industrial complex and all the nuances of it, understanding that we still can find a lot of healing in it and find our little pieces, but also understand what to navigate it.
I think something that you say very often is, let's find what is useful in this, not to throw all of it away, right? Because the systems are built and da da da. And some of these systems, trash, they got to go, right? But some of them, they're imperfect. Mm-hmm. But if we get a screwdriver and get some tape and we da 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 and put this person, right? Now there's something here, right? Mm-hmm. I think about a building. Mm-hmm. Every building ain't designed in a brilliant way, but you knock all these walls down, you start adding the walls in the right place, you put that color and that light, honey, now we got a vibe, right? And so how do we do that with these systems, mm-hmm. right? Some of them, there is value
yeah.
in them. And some of them got yeah. to go. We got to take this whole building down
yes.
and start completely new. Absolutely. But I think, you know, you remind me very, very often, what is useful here?
Yeah.
And also what is not.
Yes, yes.
Right? That we can keep what is useful. We can extract what is useful, And everything that is, does not serve us, let us let it go.
Okay.
And I think, you know, for me, that sounds like we're going to take what's useful. And if it ain't, let us let it go.
That's the affirmation. The affirmation for me is we can have the care and the wellness support that feels in dignity, that feels centered in love, that feels supportive. Even in the muckiness, we can have that. And I want you to assess for yourselves, whoever listening and watching, and is the care that I'm getting representative of that? And if it's not, how do I get support from my loved ones, my community, to find the care that will do that?
Because you deserve it.
I say, because healing is our birthright.
Healing is our birthright.
And that is my affirmation.
I love it. Thank you.
Thank you.